This is Galen Gidman, and you're listening to episode 2 of the Racer Page podcast. Welcome everybody to episode 2 of the Racer Page podcast. We had our episode 1 last week, and it was so cool to see the response to it. Really appreciate everybody that let us know how much they enjoyed it, and it definitely gives us energy to do this second one. So I'm Galen Gidman. I'm the host. Racer Page podcast is brought to you by Racer Page. Racer Page makes easy and affordable websites for racers. If you're a racer, you want a website that's going to help you grow your fan base, attract sponsors, keep everybody in the loop with what you're doing, we can build that for you. So check out racerpage.com to learn more. And as always, I'm joined with my co-host, Roger Wagner of DRN. What's up, Roger?
Nothing, man. Just happy to be back. Glad that the first one went over as well as it did. Can't wait to get this one going and see how this thing continues to grow as we go forward. I'm excited to talk about everything that is on the list for this this episode. I'm ready to get right to it, man.
And dude, we've got a great list for this episode, especially considering that really this weekend was the first race of the year. We kind of talked about it last week a little bit, but the 24 Hours of Daytona. Other than the Chili Bowl, I guess you could say it was the second race of the year. You know, you had the Chili Bowl 2 weeks ago, and then the 24 Hours of Daytona last week. But that's kind of kicks off our season, and then here as we go into the next couple of weeks, NASCAR starts, IndyCar typically in March, I think, and we'll be off to the races. No pun intended.
Literally,
no pun intended. But I mean, first off, here I wanted to kind of pick up where we left off last week. With the 24 Hours Daytona and specifically Zanardi. So for anybody that didn't catch the episode last week or kind of isn't familiar with what we're talking about, Alex Zanardi was an IndyCar driver that tragically lost both of his legs above the knees in an accident in Germany in 2001 and has been Special Olympics ever since, actually a gold medal winner and some different events at a couple different Olympics, I believe, and has gotten back into racing and competed last week in the Daytona 24 Hours using a special steering wheel and sort of like a lever, I guess, that kind of looks like, what you might imagine like a handbrake to look would look like, that allowed him to drive completely with his hands. And, for everything that they can control, it was actually a great success. Did you catch any of that?
Yeah, I actually was tuned in when they put him in the car the very first run that he was going to make in the 24 hours, and he had a little mechanical problems. The first wheel would not connect. He couldn't get the car to refire. They messed with it for a couple minutes, and then finally they just brought another wheel in, stuck it on the car, fired up, and took off. And I know that later they had an electrical problem. I think maybe when he got in the second time, they tried that other wheel again, and it shorted out the electrical system. But I watched them put him in the car. The driver getting out, got out of the car. He got over the wall, was coming in. That driver picked up a cushion that they put in the seat for him to sit in to raise him up high enough, fitted it in there real quick, got him in, started hooking up his radios. Zanardi was plugging in the steering wheel, pulling down the belts. The other driver was clipping him in. It was fantastic to watch how much help he was getting. And the whole time the announcers are talking about, he's in there, he's going to brake with his right hand. He's able to shift down with the little buttons you see on the front, explaining everything that was going on and talking about how it absolutely did not affect when the other drivers got in the car, that stuff was just kind of like a more of an eyesore than anything. It was just there to mess with their vision because all the other controls worked exactly like they're supposed to for a completely, two legs, two arms driver versus him with just his hands. And then they stayed in the car until he got out on the track. It was awesome to watch, man. I had a great, great appreciation for what he was doing and how the engineers got him to that point. And it was such a huge moment just for that race and for Alex Zanardi that it was just engaging, intriguing, and entertaining all at the same time.
Well, and I think the best part of it too is he was competitive. I mean, there's a lot of these setups that you could put in there that would let, somebody that didn't have as, many physical abilities as another person, get in there and drive the car. But, through what they did with, what were obviously really a high quality setup for him, he was competitive. They were saying that, at one point he was within 0.3 of the fastest lap that car had put down in that race and was, you know, super competitive. You know, they had the issue. I think they had an off track that cost them a few laps, and then changing the wheels, I guess, shorted out something in the steering column that they had to reset. But it was a cool story. It's great to follow up on, you know, what we were looking at last week, you know, hoping would be successful like this. And it's awesome to see that it actually was. But not everything in that race was as successful. I don't know how early you got up and were watching it in the morning, but it had been pretty straightforward race, I guess, from the green flag and through the evening. And, you know, they had some incidents, but nothing too wild or crazy. And then the rain came somewhere in the wee hours of the morning. And it was, you know, for lack of a better term, sort of a disaster. How much of that did you catch?
I came in at what would have been 9 o'clock local time, about 10 o'clock in the morning down there in Florida. And there wasn't a soul in the stands. There wasn't a soul on pit road. The coverage team was hunkered down with umbrellas and jackets and everything else. And there was water standing all over the place. And I was like, huh. I wonder what happened here. And then they start explaining it. And I'm like, oh my goodness, a monsoon happened. And they parked all the cars and they don't know if they're going to go back to racing. And there was about 2 hours left. And, you know, I watched for about 30 minutes, watched them talk about everything. And they did another cover piece on the Zanardi stuff. And then they talked about, you know, a little bit of this and that during the night, who did what, who had problems. They showed some guys working on a car in the garage area. And then, the announcement came that IMSA was going to make a decision within the next 30 minutes, and I had to go run a couple of errands, and by the time I got back, it was over, and they were announcing winners, and everybody was talking and celebrating, and I was like, well, that was kind of anticlimactic, but I wasn't sure what I missed, and then you and I talked.
Exactly. So what ended up happening, and I got to admit that I didn't kind of come in onto this process till the end of it, because I was – I'm going to admit it. I was asleep and I slept a bit late that morning, but they had been under caution. I know it's millennials, hashtag millennials, right? But right. This adulting thing, I don't know. Am I showing my age by using the term adulting?
A little bit. You didn't date yourself too much right there.
Okay. Well, I'll have to live with it. But anyway, they were under caution for about 4 hours. And I think they tried to do one restart right in the middle of it. It lasted till turn one before they all watered up again and ended up, you know, being either under caution or red for about 2 hours. One interesting story that I saw was actually Ricky Taylor was driving the Penske Acura, I believe, and actually got sick to his stomach being in the wet car. He was leading at the time, and so he's directly behind the pace car, and something about the flashing lights of the pace car and it being cold and wet and everything, it actually made him sick to his stomach. So under caution, they had to come in and do a driver change for Ricky. But anyway, long story short, they were under caution for about 4 hours. While the rain was just too intense, they thought to drive. And at that point, I guess IMSA kind of felt like enough was enough and they were just going to go green. And it didn't actually work out that well. There was a lot of carnage, lot of class leaders, you know, missing turn one. There was a few instances during the race or during that, you know, period for a couple hours while they were trying to go where, you know, you'd see three or four cars in a row coming to turn one. Lot, you know, four wheel slide, hydroplaning, and crashing into each other as they all crashed in, you know, really separate incidents, right? It was tough. So it kind of led to some good discussion. I thought, you know, how much is too much? I know in the NASCAR community, like the feeling is always, oh, give them rain tires, and you know, certainly race in the rain on the road, but give them rain tires and see what happens on an oval too, right? But I think you know, and we're always assured that won't work. But kind of when you go to these road courses, you have the opportunity, but it kind of leads to the question, like, how much is too much? And when should you back off a little bit and say, yeah, we can do this, but this is too much. This is too dangerous. What do you think?
Well, what I do is I take into consideration a bunch of factors, and I'm sure this is what IMSA did. But They may have waited a little bit too long considering how many cars crashed there, but I'm going to take driver safety first and foremost, driver safety into consideration, and then I'm going to take the team safety. Those guys are out on pit road. Cars are going to be coming in and out. You know, you're coming in on pit road. That's not going to be very dried off ever. Car hydroplane slides into your pit while you're working on your car. What's going to happen there? I'm going to take the fans' safety and entertainment into consideration, and I'm also going to take these guys wreck one of these cars. What's the cost? If they total out the car because we left them out there in the rain just a little too long, what's the cost? And you have to take all those factors into consideration. I'm stopping the race once we've been, you know, 15, 20 minutes and it's just raining harder and harder and harder and it's not letting up and it shows no signs of letting up because they have all the sophisticated weather equipment out there that you can see, you know, how the pattern of the storm is going to move. I think they should have stopped that race a long time before. And once they knew they couldn't get it back, you make one of two choices. Okay, we're going to postpone the finish of this race until everything clears off. And yes, that may be several hours. That's unfortunate, but it's for the betterment of our sport. It's for the safety of everyone involved. Or we're going to call it right now because we don't see this coming clear. And you weigh which is the absolute best choice for your series, for your sport, and for your particular event at that time. And that's what you have to go on. I don't know their process. I know that would be mine. I expect that would be theirs. But, you know, I mean, you red flag a race if too many cars crash in the same corner. Well, how many cars had to crash in that same corner before they finally stopped that thing?
Yeah, a lot. Well, I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head with the catch 22 that this is, because, you know, your comment, you know, you take into consideration the safety of the fans and the entertainment value of what you have. And those are kind of working at odds with each other in that scenario. Like, you know, not that it's great racing necessarily to see cars try to drive in the rain, but the entertainment value, especially, you know, if it happens, you know, fairly infrequently, is pretty high actually to see those guys try to, you know, pull it together in the rainstorm. I think safety has to come first. The reality is that those cars are pretty safe. So, you know, not that you want to get them in crashes, but I think putting them in a position where they could crash, I mean, that's kind of the name of the game. But you're right. Too much is too much at a point. And I think, you know, from the team's perspective, IMSA probably went a little too far. And I think you've got some fans that are bummed they didn't get to see the race end in, you know, a dramatic fashion. I mean, the Fernando Alonso passed in the Wayne Taylor Racing car for the lead about, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes before the race went red flagged for the final time. And It was because the Whelen Engineering car in front of him, the 31, just flat missed the corner, missed turn one and overshot it. And, you know, Alonso got slowed down in time, and it was kind of an anticlimactic moment. And then, you know, you get the final red flag a few minutes later, and that's all she wrote.
Of course, it wasn't under good racing conditions, was it? It was already wet, right?
It was pouring. Yeah, it was very wet.
Okay, so there's something right there. The outcome of the race possibly changed at that point. Now, is that something that the fans wanted to see? Probably not. I mean, the fans that were cheering for Alonso and them, yeah, of course, they wanted to see him get in front. But a road racing fan, which most of the people that go and watch road racing, they are a fan of a particular driver or a particular team, but they in general just want to see very good, very competitive, very close racing. And that was, as you say, completely anticlimactic. And I know this, I watched enough of the broadcast on Saturday. They went around on the infield, and there are so many different car clubs that bring all of their Porsches and Ferraris and all, and they have certain areas where they just have a car show during the race. Well, all of those people were still there until it got really late, and everyone saw that all this weather was coming in, and they started to clear out. But had the weather not come in, they all stay there. They wait for the finish of the race. If they know they're going to get to see a live green flag finish to a race, I'll bet you the majority of them get to stick around. They just cover up their cars because they want to see that finish in that particular race, but they don't want to see it in the rain, and they don't want to see somebody win it because of the factors that came with the weather. And so, I mean, you can't put it on IMSA. You can't say, hey, they screwed up. But your how much is too much? Man, I think you're walking on a double-edged sword right there. You're darned if you do and you're darned if you don't.
No, and I think you're right. But I'm going to use that point you make as a segue to the next segment and talk about the fans. And I think that was really one of the first things that stood out to me about this race was just looking at the access these fans get, man. It's incredible. One of my favorite Twitter followers is Jeff Gluck. He wrote for USA Today for quite a while and some other different sports papers before that. But now he runs jeffgluck.com, and he's really a great follow on Twitter. And then to read his blog, he covers motorsports. And he was out there and just covering the event and was really, you know, struck by the access the fans get, whether it be on, you know, pit road where they're, you can walk right up to the car, you can touch the car, you can walk, you know, right up to Fernando Alonso or Jordan Taylor or Juan Pablo Montoya or, you know, Elio or any of those guys. And the access that the fans get there is really unparalleled.
I actually kind of liken it to some of the dirt races that I've been to with some of the bigger names, the World Outlaws, the Lucas Oil late models, some of that stuff. Because if you get your pit pass, you really do walk around in the pits with all of those guys. It's not like there's a roped off area like when you go to a NASCAR race where there's certain areas you can and can't go. You get a pit pass, you're in the pits. You're just like a driver. You're just like a crew member. You're down there with them. You can walk right up and talk to them. You can stand, you know, inches away from their car watching them work on it. So I think that kind of access is very endearing to fans, and that's why you see the throngs of people that you saw. Not to just say that the 24 Hours of Daytona is not a big race. It's one of the biggest sports car races in the world, period. But that kind of access makes it just that much more endearing to the fans and, you know, makes them feel more connected to it, and that's why you have the giant crowd, because they had a huge crowd down there for the weekend.
Yeah. So do you think like NASCAR should look in that direction? I mean, I think we can all agree that, you know, NASCAR is struggling right now as a sport. I mean, there's still a lot of fans. There's still a lot of people that like it. I'm not saying it's dead, and I'm not even saying that this is the fix for it. But I mean, it's an interesting concept to me anyway. You know, NASCAR gives you more access than like F1 does, but nowhere near what you see at, you know, like you said, a dirt track or even, you know, some of these sports car events. I kind of think it's something NASCAR should look at. What do you think?
Well, it's a tough call, and you're going to play devil's advocate a little bit either way you look at it. There is a lot of proprietary information that you can just look at a car and see sometimes, and allowing, you know, just anybody close access, somebody on a payroll, somebody for another team can see something that you're doing in a Chevy that they're not doing in the Toyota or vice versa, et cetera, et cetera. And you don't want to get that close because it's supposed to be stock car, which means they're all supposed to be equal and supposed to come down to the driver. And that couldn't be further from the truth, because every one of those, Ford, Chevy, Toyota, all have special little things that they do. And each team has even more specialized things that they do. And you don't want to give away your secrets. That's why you don't get to go stand on the top of an Indy car. You don't get to go in the F1 pits and walk right up to a car. Things like that. Now, having access to drivers, they make that so that there are places where that's possible. It may be for a limited time. It may be, you know, a certain spot. And it does give fans access. And if you're a fan of a driver, you know where to find that person at certain times. But to go to a dirt track, be able to walk around the pits and talk to a driver, to be able to go down there to the Rolex 24 Hours at Daytona, walk out onto the paddock, walk right up on the grid, walk right next to a car and shake a driver's hand, there's no other group that can and probably will do that, just for the reason everything is kind of secret squirrel. And it's sad, but it also serves a purpose. So I'm not going to blame anybody. Do I think they should do it? I would love to see them do it. I used to be the biggest NASCAR fan, and I have pulled back just a little bit because they have watered their brand down so far that it's tough to watch and it's tough to stay a major fan of it because of everything they take away from the fan. all that access, breaking up races into these segments and causing, you know, cautions and making the racing so that it's not the 500 mile race. Guys are breaking it down into 100 mile three or four times and just planning on being able to run their car that hard or in a fashion for that long. So, no, I don't think they should do it. And I don't know anything they could do to probably recover from the tailspin that they're in.
Well, I think I think their tailspin, that's probably another episode. But I bet, you know, one of the things that NASCAR would be worried about in giving, you know, fans more access, especially on the grid, you know, the pit road before the race, those cars, you know, are so aerosensitive and the teams know so well where if I put a dent in this right side door, I mean, we saw, I want to say it was maybe 2 years ago, on a pit stop, at Pocono, Brad Keselowski's crewman kind of hip checked the right side door and, you know, where they were able to put a dent in it in the right place. And NASCAR actually caught them that time and made them come back and fix it. But I'm sure it happens week in and week out where we don't see it. If you had, you know, guys that close to the car, and in fact, you know, now that I bring this up, I remember seeing a tweet from Travis Mack, who was on the 88 team and then went and spent part of last season crew chiefing the 95 for Casey Kane, saying, man, what could I do to the car in that crowd, you know, that NASCAR wouldn't catch, you know, maybe accidentally trips and, you know, maybe the side skirt accidentally flares out at just the right, you know, way that maybe it accidentally gets a little more downforce, or maybe you put a dent in the door in just the right spot. So I think that's what NASCAR would probably be most concerned about, because you know what happens. I mean, I want to say there's been a couple of scenarios too where NASCAR's dinged Stuart Haas. I think it was the 41 one time and maybe another team a different time for, you know, unapproved body modifications, you know, as they were rolling the cars out from the garage to pit road. So, I mean, there's so
they've
much
done it for them on pit road. Guys, yeah, trying to pull that side skirt down at the back, right in front of the rear tires on the right side.
Yeah,
trying
that to that was the deal in 2014. Totally.
Exactly. And they got several teams with that year. And since then, they've got a couple. And you know, the old saying in NASCAR is, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. And that's probably the biggest reason why they don't allow it, is because who knows what can happen. I mean, I've seen them they wrecked the right rear of a car in practice on Saturday and went ahead and just patched it up with some Barabond and straightened out the metal and a few rivets here and there just to keep that car on the track, because that little bit of damage actually worked in their favor. Exactly. Put that right rear corner out just a little or up just a little or whatever it may be. And, you know, I'm sure that's probably part of it, but I don't think we'll ever see the easy access to the cars and the drivers like we do in several other series. But NASCAR has done so much to themselves over the last 10 years that I think the casual fan has kind of already moved on.
You know, you might be right, and I hope you're not, but they've definitely got their work cut out for them to reinvent themselves in a way that, you know, both appeals to new fans and also can retain, you know, what they have left, and in a perfect world, maybe entice some of the people that have become a little bit disenchanted. But I, you know, this gives us another, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think we can have a whole nother episode and talk about all of the things that are rumor milled and semi-confirmed and stuff going forward, like electric cars by 2022 or 2024, whatever it is, et cetera, et cetera. And we could have a whole nother episode just about NASCAR, and we can either love them or hate them. I don't know which it'll be, but I'm sure we can pick two sides and kind of, you know, have a great debate over it. But as far as that goes, NASCAR is NASCAR, and they're going to do what they want to do.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things they are doing, and I'm going to use this is my professional radio/podcaster transition that is so smooth that nobody actually even notices we're doing it. So just want to give you a heads up that that's what we're doing here. But we're going to use that to smoothly transition into another thing I wanted to talk about, which is iRacing. So you and I are both very familiar with iRacing, and cracking up smooth over there.
I apologize, but that was so not smooth, and I had to get the smooth transition in there for you, that iRacing and NASCAR together with the Peak Antifreeze Series, and tonight they're having their live driver draft, and I know that's where you were going, so I'm going to help you get back on track and get to that. by stating that that is going on live. While we're sitting here recording this, they are live drafting drivers from the iRacing platform to real NASCAR esports teams.
So I was pulling this up and actually seeing who was involved, and it's an impressive list. So we have Wood Brothers Racing, which, I mean, anybody that's seen NASCAR since, I don't know, like the 50s knows who they are. Flipside Tactics, which I believe is an esports team. I got to admit that I'm not really into esports outside of iRacing, so I'm going to just show my ignorance there. And then you got Junior Motorsports, Joe Gibbs Racing, Williams as in the F1 team Williams, Burton Kligerman Esports, and so that's probably Parker. I know Parker's really into iRacing, and A. Burton, there's quite a few to pick from, so I imagine it's one of them. JTG Doherty has an esports team, Clint Boyer Racing, Roush Fenway, and Team Richmond Raceway Esports. They're all drafting drivers. So what they've done is they've thrown the top 40 iRacing drivers into a pool, and there's 12 teams, and each team, I believe, gets to pick two drivers. And those drivers get a $500 cash bonus for having gotten picked onto one of those teams, and they run an official livery. And then, you know, as other teams join the series, as the year goes on, then they get to pick from the remaining pool of drivers. And this is all to compete for a $100,000 championship purse.
Yeah, a very big change compared to what the NASCAR and Pro Series has been in the past. Even last year's Peak Antifreeze Series, only $10,000 went to the winner. And this year, I think they've upped that to $25,000 for the winner.
$40,000. The winner gets
$40,000. There you go. And so this, coupled with bringing all of these real life, big time racing teams in, is the next step in the evolution of taking sim racing into the mainstream and making it one of the big tournament type esports, and it becoming something that you can sit down and when you watch E-League and all that, this will be something that you'll be able to view live as it's happening. And guys will be sitting, you know, probably at home in their sim rig all over the world doing this, because they do have drivers, not just from the United States, but they are from all around the globe competing in this thing. And it's become a really, really big deal. You've already, in the last 5, 6, 7 years, been able to get an official, you know, NASCAR champions ring. They give you a big trophy. You get to go to the banquet, all of those things. So it's actually taken the next step, and it's becoming an even bigger evolution than it was, you know, this time last year. So it's pretty exciting time.
Well, I mean, I think it's just the next step as NASCAR, and not even just NASCAR, but, you know, World of Outlaws and even Rallycross, you know, as we try to blur the lines between, you know, what is sim and what is real life. Not that they're ever going to be completely blurred. I mean, there's one you're sitting in your living room and the other one you're in a car going 100 miles an hour, right? So there's a difference. But some of the same skills apply, and I think that there's some crossover in the entertainment value. You know, it's still racing, even if it is in your spare bedroom. There's still a really competitive, you know, factor to it, and it still takes a lot of time and skill to master. And iRacing's been pushing really hard to get on the esports wave for a long time, you know, where you see these, you know, where you can go on ESPN2 and, you know, see like a League of Legends tournament or something like that. iRacing is trying to break into that space. And I think these bigger purses are really going to help them take the next step. You know, I don't know what their ceiling is, but this is definitely a step in the right direction.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you've got, you know, the Peak Antifreeze Series. You've already got the F1 Sim Championship Series. Those have been going on for a long time. This past year was the first year for the World of Outlaws Sprint Car and Late Model Championships, and those are both getting a huge purse upgrade. They went from a $10,000 total purse to $25,000 each this year. The Rallycross and the VRS GT World Championships are each $25,000 now. So you got six what would be major series out in the real world that have transitioned into the sim world and all have their affiliation with their real world counterparts, getting a major upgrade, getting a major boost in prize money, and getting a ton of exposure now with all of these you know, real life race teams taking an interest in all this stuff, it's not going to be too long before this is a mainstream thing, just like watching your League of Legends and what was it, CSGO and all of those that became, you know, the big esports stuff. Racing is on its way in, and you know, it's a lot cheaper to do. It's a lot easier to get into. If you've got the talent for it, you'll get noticed quickly, and it's going to be a lot easier to get picked up and put into one of these sim rides than it is to go out, chase sponsors and all that stuff, and you know, come up with millions of dollars to get into a NASCAR ride or an IndyCar car or any of that stuff. So the evolution's happening. It's a great time to be in any form of racing, but right now, sim racing is on the uptick in a great way.
You have some guys over at DRN, your dirt racing, the dirt racing network that you broadcast. Casey Kane has actually formed a dirt team, right? And they're over in your league?
They run several leagues, but yeah, some of their drivers do run in our league, Dirt Slingers Racing League, Dirty Old Bastards League, World of Thunder. All of those leagues, you'll see the Casey Kane Sim Racing team in there. You'll see the Kevin Swindell Speed Lab team in there. You're going to see the Tony Stewart Racing Sim team in there racing. I mean, you know, these guys, and all of this is starting to come together now with the advent of that world championship for the World Outlaws iRacing Sprint Car Series and Late Model Series. So all these guys getting picked up and put on these teams, the transition is happening. It's happening all over the place. I'm lucky enough to be on the inside of some of this with, you know, being a partner in the Dirt Racing Network and broadcasting these races on a nightly basis and watching these guys and seeing their evolution from forming their own teams and having the, you know, the conglomerates get together of all the big names to now getting picked up by Casey Kane, who retired from NASCAR to go dirt car, you know, sprint car racing with the World Outlaws again. He's got, I think it's 68 races or something like that planned for this year. Got a great sponsor picked up for all of that for him and Brad Sweet. And, you know, I mean, to be kind of part of that and know what's going on the inside of it is awesome, but it's also what all of us have been waiting for. And that transition is starting to happen. So now's the time to become part of the community. There's nothing more fun than, you know, becoming part of a big community of racers. If you're a racing enthusiast, this is the cheapest and easiest way to get into it.
And they could check all that info out at the Dirt Racing Network on Facebook is where they can see all those races and get into all that stuff, right?
Yeah, you can come watch. We do 8 broadcasts in 4 days. This week, we've got quite a bit going on. We're actually going to have an extra day. We have a 3,000 followers appreciation event this Friday night, 8 p.m. Eastern. We're going to give away a lot of prizes to the fans. Going to get some prizes away to the drivers. Going to have a couple of races. Going to put the 360 wing sprint cars up at Knoxville. Going to put the midgets up at either Kokomo or Lanier. That has not been officially decided yet, but that's going to happen. It's going to be a lot of fun. You know, like I said, I've kind of got the foot in the door with some of these sim guys and the big teams and the big sponsors. And so I get to hear a lot of stuff before a lot of people. Now I can't share a lot of that, but knowing that it's coming, the excitement level is starting to grow, and I am really, really looking forward to a whole lot of what's about to happen in the sim world because it's going to relate directly into people and or teams from the real world, and the series are going to start to really kind of mirror and mimic each other, and it's going to be – the lines are going to really start to get blurred, honestly. So it's a great time, and I'm happy to be part of it. Like I said, the Dirt Racing Network has been a godsend. We started it in September. We have grown leaps and bounds in the last 6 months, and it's gotten our foot in the door. So we're going to be right on the inside of the sim transition to esports in the very, very near future.
Dirt Racing Network on Facebook if you all want to check it out. And we really appreciate everybody for checking in with us again week two. We have got some awesome guests in the pipeline that we're working to book right now. And we've already got some commitments from. So we're super excited to share what's coming down the pipeline with you guys just as soon as we can. So thank you for listening. If you want to go check out episode one or see even episode two, any of the links and notes, things we talked about today, you can go to racerpage.com/podcast/2 will be the link for today's episode. And also go subscribe so you make sure to get notified as soon as the next episode comes out. And we will see you next week.